let's just begin with a couple of announcements or logistical issues. One of you emailed me and asked that the readings be the questions be tagged to the readings so that you know where to look for answers to the questions. And starting next week, I'll do that. There are some questions which sort of straddle the reading as a whole, and so you won't always see that. But to the extent that I can do it, I'll try to tell you the reading to go to answer a particular question. And then someone else tried to get to the Wall Street Journal article that was recommended reading for this week and couldn't. Now the problem with this is that you have to actually do this from a U of M machine. So I think it needs to be in one of the computing clusters or in the residence, from a residence hall. And the reason is that the university has sort of a site license to use this stuff, but the host at the other end needs to know that it's a U of M machine. So I think if you're trying this from home, it won't work, unless you live in the residence hall. Did anyone actually try to get at this article? Yeah, did you? Were you?
They said that I needed a password.
Yeah.
And where did you try it from?
It was from U of M. It was from Ada Hawk.
Yeah.
I did
it
in the dorm.
You
did?
Yeah.
The way I did it was, I went to the library website.
Yeah.
And there's a link from there to website or whatever it is.
Okay.
I clicked that, and then I went back and put you in.
That is my thing to figure out, but that's probably too much work. It's not worth that. So what I'm going to do is just dump the article in my space and then just create a link from within my page to the article so that you solve that problem. There's a copyright issue here, which you're not supposed to access it if you're not U of M, but you take that chance for a few days. Okay, the textbook issue, I've placed a copy of the Hughes, Martin, and Sharrock, The Understanding Classical Sociology book on reserve. And both books are on order and should be here by Friday. In any case, I'll have copies, like photocopies of the readings for next week available on Thursday for folks who don't have the books. But hopefully that problem won't bother us for much longer. also, a few of you wanted the lectures to be available online. And I'll do that starting next week. I'm not quite sure what sort of format to use for it. So let me ask you a couple of questions. How many folks use primarily the IBM machines, IBM Compatibility? Okay, and the rest of you use Macs, and that's a fair number. That's part of the problem is I create the stuff on an IBM-compatible machine, and if you're using Macs, you may have some difficulty. So let me play with that and try to figure out some way of dealing with it. Do the folks who use Macs know how to use the emulator machine, emulator software that allows you to open Windows stuff on the Power Macs? Is this vaguely familiar or not? Okay, let me ask a positive question. How many folks know how to, on a Mac, know how to read Windows software? Okay, not enough. Okay, so we'll figure something out. Okay, there's one more issue with the readings, but I think I can get to that more naturally as part of the discussion. So let's get started. Let's begin with just a quick recap of last week, in which we collapsed something like 3 or 4 centuries of development into basically two class meetings, and so didn't do it nearly as much justice as it deserves. But here's what we saw, sort of the main points. that the Enlightenment and machine production of factories basically dealt a mortal blow to the system of feudalism in Europe. That was kind of the main, if there's one thing you remember from last week, that ought to be it. What that meant socially was that the old social classes in European society sort of began to be on the way out. They, of course, weren't completely destroyed. To this day, England has a queen, for example, and so does Holland. To this day, you know, there's Sir this, Sir that. For example, the guy who made the movie Gandhi is Sir Richard Attenborough. So it's not that we have some absolutely abrupt transition from one to the other, but certainly there's a big shift in who has power in the society. And we see two new groups of people who, again, aren't completely new. There were folks involved in manufacturing. There were folks who were workers who weren't peasants and who were working in the cities. But really, for the first time around the 18th and 19th centuries, these become large and significant groups of people. They actually become the main players, at least for our purposes. So that's kind of a very quick look back. Yeah, Mark.
How do you pronounce that word, the B?
Bourgeoisie? Yeah, yes. It's unfortunately a French word. But bourgeoisie means, originally the term refers to someone who came from a burg, B-U-R-G, which is just a word for a town or a city. So originally it literally meant someone who lived in cities. We'll see Marx using it in quite a different sense, and we'll get to that. Okay, now before we jump into Marx, let's ask this question again that we posed at the beginning of the class. Why should we care? This stuff happened a few hundred years ago. it's not clear that it affects our lives, at least day to day directly, although I think hopefully, as the course goes on, you can see that it does. But basically, why should we care? Now, one reason is, of course, good old-fashioned intellectual curiosity, which is why at least some of us are here. Let's put that aside and assume that's not sort of enough. Why else should we care? One way to think about this is that maybe what's happening today around us is are changes which might be about as big and as important as the changes we talked about last week. Now, how do we know this? We know this because all kinds of folks are talking about this stuff, and they use words like globalization or a new, the information age, the information revolution, the decline of the working class, the industrial working class. you'll see this in the papers, on TV, and you know, hopefully, I mean, even in movies. So maybe something is happening. Now, unfortunately, we won't really know till it's all over. People who were alive during the Industrial Revolution, some of them had some sense of exactly what was going on, but really the Industrial Revolution gets called the Industrial Revolution once it's done. And so that's somewhat unfortunate. That means in another class like this, maybe in another 50 years, we might be able to say for a fact that what's happening now is a big change. So maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But I'm going to make the argument just for fun that maybe it is. And we, because it's happening day to day in small steps, we don't really feel it in a big way. But maybe there's something to this. Think back to the steam engine, which is the last thing we saw last Thursday. And here's one machine that single-handedly is responsible for massive social changes. Not just changes in how we make things, but in changes in how we relate to one another. That's one machine. Arguably, this the role that the steam engine played back then is being played by electronic machines or the computer, basically any digital technology. Certainly this is how a lot of folks talk about it. Now, if that's the case, if you make an analogy with what the steam engine did, then we ought to be able to make some analogies with what the computer is doing to people, to work. This is actually one of the things some of you could pick for one of the long questions on the exam, because that's kind of part of the spirit of it, is to apply this stuff to things which are going on now. So what are some of these changes? Let's say if you compare the way you think about your work and your day-to-day life, compare that with how your parents talk about when they were growing up. Are there things you can point to that may or may not be related to the development of this technology that sort of sometimes strike you as being significant? I mean, yeah. Yeah, can you?
Well, like my mom was always like, when I had written papers, I always had to write them on typewriters, and it always took us a lot longer because if you made mistakes, it was harder to change. And she's always like, it took us so much longer than it takes you to write a paper these days.
Right. So that's a great example. Just the entry of text has speeded up a lot. Yeah.
Registering for classes. And they had to go. They had to go to different tables and say, I want to sign up for this class. Instead, we just go into the web, pick our class, and call up.
That's right. It's another key. Yeah.
This is a little less student life, but my coworkers at work, where it used to be, it was just people in the same building. The people I work most closely with, they're in Chicago or England or Germany or India.
That's another great example. If you make a technical support call to Hewlett Packard or Microsoft these days, your call is just as likely to go to Ireland or to India as it is to Silicon Valley or whatever, Washington, the state Washington. And you wouldn't know it, but that's what's happening. Yeah. Other things, other examples. Yeah.
I was just thinking about like pagers and telephones. Now you got email, internet service. First used to be like a garage door opener. Now they're smaller, more compact, visual.
Right. I mean, take even this, the way we organize this class, we aren't really making full use of this stuff, but the whole idea of giving you links to files that exist, you don't even have to know that the server that you clicked on for the marks and English readers in England. I mean, it doesn't matter. You should be indifferent to that. And there's some pretty serious folks who've made the argument that what's going on now, if you think back to the steam engine, the principle there was using heat to produce mechanical energy. I mean, it's a very simple, straightforward thing, but it sort of means there's a revolution in production and social relations. Similarly, what digital technology allows us to do is convert every kind of information there is, whether it's visual or text or audio information, to bits, zeros and ones. So in other words, virtually with every sense we are capable of, except the sense of smell for the moment, we are able to reduce it to the same base. Again, whether it's your eyes or your ears, your hands, things that you can do are reducible to a common denominator. And once that happens, it means some of the old distinctions we are used to get destroyed. Now, again, there are folks in computer science and so on who see this as quite revolutionary, and the effects haven't played themselves out completely. But it's something to think about. Now, one thing we have seen, which we know is happening, is that the classical industrial working class, the folks who worked in the same factory most of their lives, or if not the same factory, just down the road in Ypsilanti, there are entire generations of families who've been associated with one auto company. You know, the dad or the mom goes to work at the GM plant, so do their kids. And it's literally been going on for generations. But those folks are sort of on the way out, and you get that feeling that the numbers are declining. Traditionally, unions have been losing their membership. You know, it's, I think it's just over 10% of the workforce now that's unionized in the way it used to be. Maybe this is like the peasantry, sort of a class of people that's losing its means of livelihood because of the introduction of new technology. Maybe, maybe not. Again, we know this only after the fact. It's something to think about. And then the dissolving of national boundaries. The most, perhaps the most spectacular example of this is what's happening to Europe now. I didn't bring a map of Europe with me, but if you look at one, every country in Europe has been at war with every other country at least once in the last 3 or 4 centuries. They've all, I mean, that's been European history, basically constant warfare with, you know, changing groups, but they've almost always been at war. Now for the first time, they have the same currency, they have a common parliament, they have a common set of laws. One day they might have their own government. They just decided to form a common European military because they don't want the US to have the kind of power that it does. So this is pretty, I mean, it's a qualitative change, or at least it might be, that all of these countries are willing to put aside national differences that in the past have created no end of friction and have resulted in the deaths of tens of millions of people, and are coming together for the sake of, why are they doing this? What have you been reading in the papers and so on? Where should these countries come together? Say that.
To compete with the United States.
Okay. Yeah. To compete economically with the US, among other countries. So that it's easier to trade within their borders, so that they don't have to pay customs duties within when goods move from one country to another. So primarily for economic reasons, it seems, though there are others. So maybe 50 or 100 or 200 years from now, folks will look back on this period and say, you know, there'll be a class like this, and on the transparency, you'd say, this was a revolutionary age. Maybe. And if that's the case, then we're living through it right now. And if that's the case, then maybe this stuff might be useful, because these are the closest to us in time. These are the closest folks we have who dealt with such big questions in the way that they did. So maybe what they had to say then has something to say about us now. So that's something to think about because it's fun, and also because that's the kind of thing that I expect you to think about for the long questions on the exam, which are not strictly about an interpretation of the readings per se, but your application of the material to something that's going on now. So this would be a good time to just, you know, collect ideas in your mind. You don't have to do it formally, but just start thinking about these examples. And this is a very partial list. If you started thinking about this, you'd come up with quite a few. Okay. Any questions up to this point? Okay. Oh, here's a quick example, actually. This is the growth of the number of servers on the web. not much going on. Oh, thanks. Thank you. Not much going on back here. And a few years ago, it suddenly starts taking off. And it's not following a straight line path. It's more like an exponential curve. So that's kind of one example of just the proliferation of a particular kind of machine or a kind of technology that may ultimately turn out to be kind of like the steam engine, maybe more profound than that. Let's get to the first person that we're going to look at. It's Karl Marx. You read a little biography of him in one of the books. So he had an interesting life, as did all the folks we're going to look at. Now but there are particular problems associated with studying Marx, unlike the other folks, because, sort of paradoxically, paradoxically, because he's had by far the biggest impact of the folks we're going to look at. Whole, you know, countries have been overturned in his name. Wars have been fought. I think I saw there's an index of how often things are cited, and I think the Bible is the most cited book, at least in the West, and Marx comes second. So just as an example of how influential Marx has been. These days there's a tendency to dismiss Marx as obsolete or irrelevant, and I'm sure you've heard this, you know. If Marx was correct, why did the Soviet Union collapse? Because it did, therefore Marx must have been wrong. Now that may actually be correct. Maybe that does mean that Marx is wrong. But whether it's correct or not, it just makes it a little harder to study him today. And another problem is that he's often misrepresented and simplified by both folks who are Marxists or claim to be Marxists, and by folks who oppose Marxism. It's a very political subject. And so simplifications are made, accusations are traded back and forth, and all of this makes it difficult for the introductory sociology class to deal with him fairly. Now, what we're going to try to do, to the extent that we can, is put some of that aside, at least for the moment, and try to deal with the material as it is. Now, of course, what's really interesting about it is all this other stuff, was he right, was he wrong, and so on. But the first step, before we get to that, must be to understand what he actually said. So that's what I'm going to ask you to do, is at least for the next 3 weeks, which is how long we spend on Marx, that while you read this stuff, for a moment put aside the explicit political stuff and then come back to it once you read it. Now here's how you're going to do this. You're going to do this over 3 weeks. In each week, in this, you know, Marx wrote, in the collected works of Marx, I'm not kidding, it's in the hundreds of volumes. So and we have to do this in 3 weeks, right? So we're going to take just three main ideas, and we're going to hit upon them one in each week. And what we're going to do, instead of trying to cover a whole body of stuff, is confine ourselves to these, but try to come at them in as many different ways as we can. Now, here, let me say a word about how the readings are organized. Since one of you asked about this, last week it was easy to split the readings by day. You know, you had the French Revolution, then you had the Industrial Revolution. Now for the next 3 weeks and probably for the rest of the course, really what we have is one or two main ideas that permeate a whole set of readings. So what I'm going to ask you to do is get through as much of the reading as you can for the first day of that class, which is Tuesday. It's rarely more than 30 pages a week, so in terms of volume, I think, I hope it's doable. You'll have to tell me if it's not. And come prepared on Tuesday with the entire body of reading, because really the ideas come from the whole thing. Now for practical purposes, we will break it down into two class meetings. And what that means in practice is that as you go down the list of readings, the first few of them will be the ones we deal with on Tuesday, and then the ones below. But it's actually much harder for me to make that demarcation for these weeks than it was last week. So let me know if you have trouble with that. But for the most part, see if you can get through all the stuff before Tuesday, and we'll see how it goes. Okay, so let's consider these one at a time. Now the reason we looked at the manifesto first is that it actually lays out all the three ideas sort of briefly. And so we can use the manifesto to lay all of them out and then go through them one by one. So what we'll do for the next 2 days, so today and Thursday, is use the manifesto to cover each of them quickly, relatively quickly, and then come back to them over the next 2 weeks. So just to give you kind of a map of where we are going. Now, one of the first ideas in the manifesto that we're going to deal with is something that I hope you were somewhat surprised by, which is essentially Marx's praise for capitalism and the bourgeoisie. Now remember, this is a guy who spent his life trying to bring down a particular way of doing things. And yet he refers to capitalism as revolutionary. And this the word greatness doesn't come from the manifesto, it comes from something else. But he refers to capitalism as being a great system of production and of organization. And we're going to spend a fair amount of time on that today, and then also on Thursday. Also on Thursday, we'll take a quick look at the materialist theory of history, which there's one of the readings there was for today was the speech by Engels, which has a very kind of quick one paragraph summary of this idea, which is that how people make a living, basically it comes down to this, how people make a living is what you should look at if you want to understand everything else about the society in which they live. Their art, their ideas, their religion, their politics, all of it sits on top of the organization of the way of making a living. That's really in a nutshell. It's more complicated than that, but that's it in a nutshell. Finally, we'll see this aspect of Marx's analysis. This word transience comes from the same piece in which he uses the word greatness. And this is something very important about Marx to keep in your mind. His take on capitalism is not simple. Yes, capitalism sucks, and that's what most people know about Marx, right? That's what he said. At the same time, capitalism is great. And these two words are sort of encapsulate these ideas. It's great, but it's transient. It's great because it does a whole lot of things that we talk about today. But it's transient. Like all other economic systems, it has a beginning and it will have an end. And he claims that he understands how it's going to end, what the mechanism is. So it's great, but it's not going to last forever. it's great, but it's also oppressive, and so on. So it's this very complicated, sort of fairly sophisticated view of capitalism that's a little different from what you may have seen or read about Marx before. So I want you to keep that in mind. Okay, any questions so far? Before we get into the actual meat. Okay, the Mountain Dews are coming out, which means it's time to take a break. And so again, what we'll do when we come back is touch upon all of these using the Communist Manifesto, focus on the first, then we'll come back to these two on Thursday, and then cycle through them next week. Okay, let's doing pretty well on time, so let's take about 5 minutes and we'll come back. Can you guys hear?
No.
Okay.
If you know, this big revolution occurred, the Industrial Revolution and the Enlightenment, I personally don't see how much anything has changed since before the revolution and the Enlightenment. Most everybody worked for a small part of the population. And now after the revolution, most people still work for a small part of the population. And the only thing is they just have a different name. Instead of being nobility, they're owners of factories and stuff.
Okay. It's a great question. Did you guys catch it then? Okay. So if you'll allow me, just rephrase it a little bit. It's a great question to ask, and it's exactly what, if you go back to the history of the time, there's a whole movement that develops almost right away as soon as the factories start coming up. You might have heard of workers who went around smashing machines, of throwing, some of you know the origins of the word sabotage, but the word sabot is the French word for shoe or boot, and that's literally what workers would do, is throw their shoe into the machine, you know, so it would break down. And a lot of folks were saying, hey, old wine in new bottles, you know, got rid of the old masters, here's the new ones. What's changed? And this is one thing that distinguishes Marx from other critics of capitalism, and there were many, is that Marx actually saw something else going on, which he pointed to. So here's a quote from the Communist Manifesto, which sort of repeats the point that Marx made, that Marx made here. The bourgeoisie has but established new classes, new conditions of oppression, new forms of struggle in place of the old ones.
Yeah,
that's true. However, if you get the reading, you'll know that something else is going on. And to get at this, what we're going to do is, if you guys could form groups of four or at most five to answer this, try to take a crack at this question. Why for Marx, why does Marx say that the bourgeoisie has played a most revolutionary part, even though he also says that what it's done is exchange old masters and new ones. Now, when you guys get together, I'd like you to also do one logistical thing, if it helps you, this is optional, is to, within the four or five of you, is create an email mailing group amongst yourselves for that group, so that you have a way to just talk about this stuff as you're doing it. I find that helps, or that did help me when I was back a long time ago when I was taking classes. It's up to you, it's optional. I would encourage it. And then to deal with this question, and we'll do this for a few minutes, see how much you can come up with from the reading. There's no mystery about this, it's all there. So let's take a crack at this. Four, no more than five people in a group. And what you're trying to do is answer this question right up here. So you're going to get a lot of
oh shit. Definitely, like between the two class, like some people were paid, like they weren't really paid for their work. I mean,
yeah,
like,
well, not necessarily payment.
You said upper class, like they weren't really benefiting from the goods that they made.
Mm-hmm.
And even before like the Industrial Revolution, they weren't paid for the benefits or the goods that they made. Other people were benefiting off it. And they were just like, okay, well, yeah, you did your work, that's fine, that's good, and everything like that. The most whole idea behind capitalism is they're like the upper class pretty much benefit because of their resources, whereas the lower, not low class, but the lower class don't benefit based off the work that they do.
Oh,
but I did a lot of the writing when you were just trying to get the general point. I didn't know how far to read, so I accidentally read damn near up to here.
No.
Yeah, here it is. It says, like, the idea of alienation of labor is that the more obvious the work is produced, the fewer you can possess, the more you fall into the domination of the product of capital.
workers' efforts to enrich and empower those who oppressed and kept us and to empower us themselves. And he also made something about private property. And he said it's not a part of natural human conditions, which means like people owning private property. You know, they deny benefits to other people. And he was a true terrorist.
Those who are oppressed have been like inspired and pushed by the bourgeoisie to like try hard to like want equal democracy, some sort of a democracy. And, so the bourgeoisie is like the upper working class. Yeah, the upper working class is pretty much like the upper class. I mean, here in the States, anyway.
Still workers, but that were like given certain titles, like a lawyer or a priest. They were, all of those people were put into one comp of people. Those were the labor workers. Yeah, it was just.
I'm still a little lost on what they meant. The definition of like a proletariat was. Proletariat is made up of very large.
Yeah, that's the large part of
bourgeoisie
was a very minimal amount of people. It was very small. That's the minority. That's what the whole thing was. Is that
the minorities were actually the ones in control?
Exactly.
That's the switch. Cause people to want to rise up and change, like work better, because there's like when we get into Weber, I was talking about this in my previous class. There's a reason why they set up economic society. Like there's two people. There's a guy named Adam Smith who said, "No, I think everybody should just do as they want to in their own self-interest, and the economy would be fine." But there's this other guy who says, "No, you need the government to do that." To perform efficiently and stimulate the market. So, in a sense, you need the bourgeoisie to stimulate, like, not only the market, but production or the industrialization. I'm trying to find a thing to pinpoint where I'm trying to say. It's really hard to say.
It is. Well, they started, you know, forming trade unions and everything. So, I mean, because that was a way for everybody to band together and say, no, this isn't right that we're working 14-hour days.
Back in the day, they was hitting 18 hours.
Yeah.
They had 12-year-old kids hitting the sling.
Right.
I think that's probably why it's the most revolutionary part. All these people being oppressed, and that's what caused the revolution. Because it was oppressing the laborers. That caused the revolution.
Right.
Into these groups that wanted change.
And since they were the majority, it's always easier to for the majority to take over
to
than the minority.
Up.
Yeah.
Workers well, they needed workers all. also besides to run this.
Right, they feel like since the machines will come there, I can pay you less.
They didn't realize that they had to keep their workers happy.
That's what minimum wage is. I mean, that would pay you less if I could, but it'd be illegal.
Yeah, exactly.
And minimum wage also means they don't give a shit about you. They were talking to me today about minimum wage in the middle class. I'll be damned if you make $5.15 in McDonald's. I'll be damned if you're the middle class. The managers in McDonald's ain't even middle class. They will tell you that, man. Kids ain't got no shoes on their feet. They ain't got no good clothes to come to work. That's why they always got that damn shirt. I swear. Okay.
I'm definitely gonna start taking my time to get to work.
Let's start with you folks in the back over there. Yeah, you guys. The one behind you. Yeah. Someone from that group, can you say what you came up with? Let's collect the list and then talk about it. So that is a great start. How about you folks right here?
What the bourgeoisie did is they opened the path for future revolution. By breaking down the former institutions that were held up, I think, as divine rights, which, unless you don't believe it, you can't really say much against. Their institutions were founded on reason and ability. And Marx points out that those are the tools that the proletariat are going to use to break down. Previous institutions, they create a path where they can be overthrown.
They create a path?
Right, or a means to be overthrown themselves. The tools are just not their own, but they can be used by them.
Okay, that's another great point. So it basically creates its own grave diggers. Okay, that's good stuff. About you folks right over here. Yeah. You guys.
Okay. From a quote, what was the quote from? From the manifesto?
Yeah.
From the manifesto where he talks about how self-interest is laid bare in capitalism. Whereas before, like in the feudal state, there was this facade of the feudal lord taking care, watching over the people, so there's less chance for revolution. It didn't seem as inevitable, whereas in the capitalist state, it's so obvious that the workers are being exploited that it seems like revolution is absolutely necessary because they're going to eventually get tired of being exploited, and it's going to be that final revolution leading to the new stage of communism, or whatever the communist state.
Okay, very good. So it strips away the illusions of feudal society. Right. Okay, anything else now? Sort of, let's have it as a free for all. Why else is the bourgeoisie revolution? Yeah.
Social distance between like the worker
split society up into these two big chunks of people. Yeah.
He also points out, quoting, the bourgeoisie cannot exist without constantly revolutionizing the instruments of production, and therefore the relations of production and with them and the whole relations of society, which is a pretty marked change from the institutions that preceded the sort of revolution, which relied more on things being fixed in stone.
Okay. Okay. So compared to previous systems, it innovates more, right? It creates more. Okay, there's not much more to it than that. We've sort of accumulated the reasons here. Let's just go through them systematically so that we sort of have them all down. Now, again, you don't have to accept the validity of this way of looking at it. You may still, at the end of it, conclude, perhaps Mark will say at the end of all this that, well, it still means there's some people on top and a lot of other people who work for them and work in the same. So you may still conclude that. But let's see what Marx says about this. So this is something at least a couple of you said.
Could you
raise
that up?
Oh yeah, sure. How's that? Okay, so one of the reasons the bourgeoisie is revolutionary is that in contrast to the very fine distinctions of the feudal period, where not only were you a noble, but you were a noble of a particular kind, or you had a particular status, and there were all kinds of fine distinctions. If you were a peasant, you could be a small peasant, a big peasant, and so on. And there's a sort of complex social hierarchy that ranks people and that dictates what they're going to be allowed to do. That's at least how Marx claims feudal society was. In the place of that, capitalism does the following. It splits society up into what Marx calls two great hostile camps, the bourgeoisie and proletariat, the capitalists and the workers. Now, this is a good place to talk about some definitions. For Marx, the bourgeoisie is, the definition is, those folks who own the means of production. The means of production are the factories, also the big banks, and the folks who own this stuff are the bourgeoisie. The workers are everyone who works for the bourgeoisie, or in more technical language that we'll get to next week, they're the ones who have to sell their labor power to the capitalists. So a person's skill becomes a commodity which a person takes to the market and waits until someone buys that skill for some period of time. So that's the definition of a worker, someone who is selling their skill or their labor power. Now again, Marx is aware of, that there's also this middle class, the professionals, lawyers, and so on, who aren't the big bourgeoisie and who aren't the workers, who sort of fall in between, and he has something to say about them too, that they either go up or they go down. That the tendency for the folks in the middle is they aspire to go to the top. That's kind of the class interest, is to try to rise to the top. But every time there's an economic crisis, a whole bunch of them will fall down into the ranks of the proletariat. So he's aware that there are folks who don't, who aren't in the bourgeoisie and who aren't in the workers. But his claim is that the rest of the folks in the middle, over time, either get bumped up upstairs or get dropped. So for the moment, we'll just concentrate on the bourgeoisie and proletariat. So that's one thing revolutionary about capitalism or about the bourgeoisie. It makes things simpler, okay, compared to feudal society. And then this is also what some of you guys said. The bourgeoisie, wherever it has got the upper hand, has put an end to all feudal, patriarchal, and idyllic relations. So again, what you said about stripping away the sort of sentiments or some of the illusions of the feudal system, wherever the bourgeoisie gets the upper hand, it replaces all of that with what Marx calls the cash nexus. Now, I wish I'd brought this in. The latest issue of Town and Country magazine, which has Giorgio Armani on the cover, has a special section on divorce. And presumably the folks who read Town and Country are pretty well off, so this sort of makes sense. But the section on divorce is about how to manage a good divorce, like what's a successful divorce. And given that about 60% of marriages end in divorce is not an unreasonable thing to talk about. And the section begins not with what you might have guessed is, let's say, how to treat kids during the divorce, which presumably is pretty important. But the first thing is what? Yeah, how to avoid costly disputes about money, and if you do have to have those disputes, how to make sure that you come out on the winning side. That's the first section. Then right after that is how to take care of the kids. So it's not that that's not important, but really the first thing is the money. Now presumably this matters only to people who have lots of money. For other folks, you know, it's not that big a deal. But that's sort of what Marx is talking about, is the stripping away of sentiment and replacing it by the sort of what he calls a cold calculation of cash. And that's revolutionary for Marx, because it sort of destroys the basis for having illusions, basically, about how things work. It makes them transparent, okay? And then the bourgeoisie's technological sort of role or development, which also you guys raised. In Marx's time, it had been around for about 100 years, depending on how you count. And according to Marx, the bourgeoisie has created more massive and more colossal productive force than all preceding generations put together. And he has that paragraph where he talks about, you know, you put everything together, the Great Wall and the Egyptian pyramids and so on, you put all of this together and the bourgeoisie has outstripped all of this in showing what people can accomplish. You might remember at the end of the film we saw last Thursday about the Industrial Revolution, where he talks about how much stuff we extract from the earth to make other stuff, and it's all in the a few hundred million tons of copper, steel, I mean, not steel, but you know, all the stuff that we get out of the ground every year. This is huge. I mean, before this, I mean, who would have dreamt that this kind of engineering was possible? And that, for Marx, is a good thing. Just keep going through the list, and then we'll stop and come back and go through all of it again, just to make sure that it's clear. Bourgeoisie has created a world market. Now, it's not like people weren't trading across national boundaries before. Remember, for example, Marco Polo or all these folks who routinely went across long distances and exchanged things and made profits and so on. So it's not like the whole concept of that kind of trade is new. What's new is the scale, is that the entire market becomes the entire world becomes a market for the bourgeoisie. If you're familiar with the colonial history of Europe, you'll know that there were whole countries where markets did not exist, and then the various European countries invaded them and made them markets. So that's what he's talking about here, is that by force, or by means of trade. One way or the other, the bourgeoisie unites the world into one market. You know, at huge cost, of course, both to the people in, say, countries like England, and also the countries that get colonized. But it brings them together. What's good about this is that national one-sidedness and narrow-mindedness become more and more impossible. Now, of course, this wasn't strictly true back then. It's not true now. We haven't gotten rid of national narrow-mindedness. But Marx's claim is that once you have people living in such a way that, you know, I mean, when you wake up tomorrow morning, try to think of the sequence of, be conscious of the sequence of steps you go through. Take a look at where maybe your toothpaste is made, certainly your clothes, you know, the technology you use and so on. Marx's claim is that for each person to carry on their day-to-day life, they're in a sense united with people they might never see from across the world. And that's a good thing. It at least lays the basis for bringing people together, whatever their characteristics or their national origins. So this is again one of the things that's revolutionary about the bourgeoisie. And then this last point, which this is the most, it's actually only one, it's sort of the same point, but this is the quote you might see most often from the Communist Manifesto. And it's a little bit like the Declaration of Independence that we saw last week. Even if you've seen it, you know, let's sort of take a look at it just because it's quoted so often and it kind of encapsulates the whole idea. So the bourgeoisie cannot exist without constantly revolutionizing the instruments of production and thereby the relations of production, and with them the whole relations of society. Please don't copy this because it's all in your books. Conservation of the old modes of production in unaltered form was, on the contrary, the first condition of existence for all earlier industrial classes. So actually this industrialism, sort of a mistranslation here, it should be all earlier ruling classes. So Marx's claim here is that previous to capitalism, the stability of, or the existence of the folks on top depended much more on things remaining the way they were than on things changing and improving. So Marx claims that the bourgeoisie is the first class which, in order to exist, has to change constantly, has to improve the means of production as quickly as it can. Now, why is this? This is how we live. So why is the bourgeoisie compelled to do this? If you're Microsoft, or if you're Sam, sit there.
Make more money.
Right, but why can't you just say sit still and continue making money?
There's somebody else. Somebody else will come in and try and
pay. Right. Right. Or in the case of the big companies with the other folks who are trying to do the same. So yeah, if you don't do something better, someone else will, and then they'll capture the market. now this is unlike, at least Marx claims, this is unlike the feudal ruling classes who really didn't have to deal with much of this stuff. For example, the way agriculture was done remained pretty much the same for hundreds of years, though there were inventions like the plow and so on. But for the most part, it kind of remained static until the bourgeoisie came on the scene. So again, the bourgeoisie cannot exist without constantly innovating. Constant revolutionizing of production, uninterrupted disturbance of all social conditions, and everlasting uncertainty and agitation distinguish the bourgeois epoch from all earlier ones. All fixed, fast-frozen relations with their chain of ancient and venerable prejudices and opinions are swept away, and all newfound ones become antiquated before they can ossify. All that is solid melts into air, all that is holy is profaned, and man is at last compelled to face with sober senses his real condition of life and his relations with his kind, with others. Okay, so this is what's revolutionary about the bourgeoisie. It keeps changing the world because it has to. That's the only way it can survive. In so doing, it constantly destroys old ways of living and constantly throws up questions in people's minds about how they live and so on. Now, these are all claims. This may or may not be, in fact, how it works. But this is certainly what Marx is saying about it, is that all that is holy is profane, for example. Okay. So let's start over. And that was just kind of to get the flavor of things. Questions about this. He's really talking about he wrote the Communist Manifesto in 1848, and the French Revolution happened in 1789. And so by the time he's writing, he's assuming that the Third Estate, which was the bourgeoisie, has won and has consolidated its rule. And so now he's talking about the proletariat rather than those guys. No, you still look puzzled.
So the Third Estate was a majority revolution, but it's not
acknowledged in that. Oh, okay. It was a majority revolution in that it represented most of the people in France compared to the First and Second Estates. But within the Third Estate, it's actually the upper middle class that really ultimately comes to the top of France, and then more or less over Europe over a period of time, and becomes the new ruling class. And so Marx chooses to call that the bourgeoisie. And so now when he's talking about the proletariat being the movement of the great majority, he's actually talking about basically everyone. So another piece of the hand. Okay. Other questions about the revolutionary character of the bourgeoisie? Or about any of this stuff? Yeah.
$17 an hour, but that's not going to be status quo like during that time. And I'm just wondering, like, when are all these people going to realize that they're getting crumbs, that they're fighting over these crumbs while everyone else is making money? Like, $1 million is not what it was yesterday, or Kevin Garnett wouldn't be trying to get 127 of it. So, you know, I'm just wondering what's thought of us now about this little bit of money that you argue about, which is nothing.
Well, that's a great question, and that's the kind of thing. Want to deal with it for the part where you need to tackle what this stuff means to you. That's absolutely the kind of thing to look at. Maybe I should bring in some numbers about this. If you look at the wealth holdings in the US, it's pretty narrowly, the actual ownership of the means of production is very narrowly concentrated. it's about a couple of percent of the population, maybe less, like you said. So certainly what Marx would take that to mean is that the rest of the folks are, even if, as you say, even if they're fairly well off in terms of standard of living, so long as you exist by having to sell your labor power as a commodity, so long as that's the condition of your existence, you belong in the proletariat, even if you make $17 or $20 an hour. Most computer programmers make pretty good money these days, so yeah.
So the bourgeoisie was just mainly the people that owned the major factories or the major products.
Yeah.
Even people that owned, like, even like, I don't know, like people that nowadays would be considered middle class were not part of the bourgeoisie. It was just the owners of major factories.
Yes, yes. That's the strict Marxist. Let me just say one more thing about that, and then he had another term for the other folks, which was the petty bourgeoisie, and petty just means small. So most middle class folks would be in that category. Yeah.
I'm just wondering how selling one's labor is so different from the way it had been in the past. I mean, in the past you were using your labor to produce food, and then you were giving the food away.
Yes.
It's just a different sort of payment system. I'm just wondering really how fast the change was.
Okay. If you'll permit us to defer that question to the third week, which is when you look at that in great detail. So that's exactly, it's a version of Marx's question here, but phrased a little more technically, and we'll get to that. Go. Any others? Yeah. Oh, we still have a few minutes. Go ahead, speak up.
No, I was going to say, you saying, how do you purchase you somebody's
wait,
labor?
Can we have a little bit of quiet? Yeah, go ahead.
If I understood the question, he was like, how do you capitalize on some purchase of somebody else's labor? Well, is that the question? Was that your question? How you capitalize on somebody else's labor?
I was just wondering what the difference is between selling your labor and, like, labor as a commodity versus production.
They were able to get a lot more stuff, not just what they were helping. But, like, you know, they get, if they were picking fruit or something, they'd be able to get the fruit. They
right.
wouldn't get money to get something other than fruit.
But Marx seems to talk about, like, such a bad, such a horrible thing to be used
well,
solely
I mean, if
for
you specialize, but if you, like, specialize in something, you say, like, you know, during that time they were building a lot of machines, steam engine machines, they needed people who could specialize, who could build the machines. So, of course, you need to capitalize on somebody who's an expert at building machines. But after the machine was built, your labor was no longer needed. But say you need somebody to run the machines, then you get somebody who specializes in running the machines. So you just kind of go in that cycle, I guess.
Okay, yeah, you guys are getting a slightly different aspect of the question. But yeah, there's the issue of having a certain kind of labor power to be sold and then having that become obsolete because of a change or needing some other thing. And there's this other issue of Marx claims that sort of a little closer to what Tina was just saying is that the fact that you can sell your labor power means, in a sense, that you're free to, and you can sell it to anyone. In principle, you can sell it to anyone. Whereas if you're a serf, you're really confined to that piece of land, and you get what you, a portion of your work back. But yeah, you don't get all this other stuff. I mean, this is all in principle. But that's one piece of it. And we'll see it more fully in a couple of days. That's a great question. Okay, see you all in a couple of days.
If any of you participated in the discussion today and you wouldn't mind filling out a very brief speaker information form, we would appreciate it.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Actually, it's an ongoing study, and what it is, it's collecting a database of speech, and so what we do is we take all the recordings and we transcribe them word for word.
So it's a linguistic thing.
Yes, it's definitely a linguistic thing. And some of the transcripts are published on the web, so if you're interested in, I can give you the website where you can see.
Sure, yeah. Can you just tell? I'll try to remember.
Okay, www.hti, stands for Humanities Text Initiative,
okay.
umich.edu/mycase. The name of the project is
yeah.
mycase.
Okay.
Michigan, M-I-C-A-S.
All you're doing is boosting me up.
Sure.
I at least want one of them doctors.
Thank you.
I at least want 10 of them doctors. I'm taking that you're going to have a night. Not even though you put these rules where I have to be here at a certain time. I have to come in a certain time. You owe me. You owe me. Even though I'm doing all this, I'm still at work. I'm making $30 million. I'm 127. If you don't come to that game, you can put out the league. You play everybody else. They got all rules for everybody who don't want to act.
Yeah, but some people don't get that. He can miss like two or three games. Like, no. He got a contract. That's the contract. So.
It's all to a certain extent. You know, somebody on a visualizer is only going to take so much before it looks like that you're trying to overpower them. No matter how much money you make from them, they can't make people think you can't look better than them. So what's the point of you? Just think of all of us in this classroom. Most of the people in this classroom does not even think about capitalism. They think about how they're going to feed their families. At 5:15 an hour is not making it. Now, I live in Detroit, Michigan, and I can't afford to stay here. And I'm struggling.
Good luck.
I'm struggling trying to make it in this university. Yeah, I'm struggling to make it a U of M to say for what? So I can go out here and work for these people 10, 15 hours a day? What is better than being at home selling drugs or being in jail somewhere?
See, some people got that heatedness. Like, hey, I'm living for the day.
You know?
I can make $1,000.
Or do they say that the world gonna blow up in 2000 so everybody can tear it up again? Hey, I don't know what they're doing, but I'm not a part of any of it. I just go home and come to school. Hey. That's one thing that they got right. It seems we're in school and we're still talking about Mark, so I guess I'll just stay in school. Maybe something will come out of it.
Shop, but you know, they want the best, so we're gonna go with that.
Oh, this thing, oh.